Okay, so this episode is going to be really interesting because we're going to be talking to people who were on the ground in East Denver, and I really wanted to have them on because I thought it would be interesting to hear what they thought of the events. I was personally not there, so I can't like give my hot take on what happened and like what I think about things besides, you know, the things that were recorded and I was able to see like through YouTube or whatever else. So yeah, so today I have Marissa and James, who were both at East Denver representing crypto leftists everywhere they could, I know, to see what it was like on the ground at East Denver. So how you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. Maybe just to start, would you guys want to just give a really quick introduction to yourselves and like why you decided to go to East Denver?
Sure. Marissa and I were both on PacDAO, both team members there, and, you know, sort of wanted to have some more conversations. I mean, especially at the Shelling Point conference with other people focusing on public goods. And I mean, something I noticed with like a lot of stuff going on at ETH Denver was it's not exactly all necessarily like DeFi or like startup focused. There's a lot of people talking about like the community and the ecosystem and sort of how to go beyond that. And for me, that's like exactly what I'm interested in, whether it's governance or just creating sort of community tooling. There's a lot of like insight and conversations to be had there that like, and as well as meeting up with other crypto leftists who like, you know, there was more than just Marissa and I there. And
how many people were there like from the crypto leftist group?
I think there were like two or three others or maybe four others, but I think we met other people who sort of identified with crypto leftist as a title without being a part of the community.
Yeah, I definitely think there were quite a few others. But yeah, mirroring what James said, you know, I originally was like, ETH Denver, that sounds ridiculous. Like, I will not be there. Like, I was pretty skeptical of just like the audience, the intention. And after James shared Shelling Point and that event with me and kind of ensured that there, this focus on community and governance and some of the things he was saying was going to be a big focus of the conference, he changed my mind. And so I decided to go. And it ended up being exactly that. It ended up being like a tale of two cities, like these like hyper consumer, like venture capital funded focused projects run like startups. And then the people talking about cooperatives and the future of work and community care and relationship. And yeah, it was quite interesting.
That was the experience like at Shelling Points where there were both like VC people and sort of cooperative people at the same place.
To me, Shelling Point felt like it self-selected for more of the cooperative, governance focused, like compensation focused, work focused, like people. Like, I don't think that it felt like quite as much speculative finance and consumer culture energy there. I could be wrong, and James would love to hear what you think, but I think that that event felt like a highlight to me because it felt like just everyone talking about the same things I want to be talking about in one room.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with that. You know, it seems like, I mean, whether it's in ETH Denver or sort of crypto broadly, this idea of there being like two camps or some kind of divide, I think definitely kind of, I was talking about a lot at the conference and people were like, yeah, I'm sort of picking up on that where there's, I mean, because they also sort of separated the talks by different buildings. And, you know, if you didn't want to walk across to, say, the, like, startup and where they had, like, the builders for, like, the hackathon, right? There were a lot of more, I think, recruiting going on and, like, DeFi-type people and then other buildings that were talking about decentralized science or the public good stuff that, like, yeah, that there was clearly, like, people self-selecting into literally two different, like, areas. And at Shelling Point, which was, you know, it's all about governance, it's all about community and stuff, I think that's where it got into more interesting, like talking to the other crypto leftists, as well as just general people there, getting into like more interesting conversations because it's less surface level than, hey, we're not just here to like make a quick buck. We're here to like build something. And then you get into like deeper questions about the kinds of governance and different, you know, externalities that could need to be taken into consideration. And I think it's like, it was a very productive environment for that reason, because it's not just like, hey, are you here to get rich? It's like, okay, we're all trying to build something better, but what does that look like? And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of back and forth that can happen there that's more generative than just VCs get out.
You're saying it was productive because you had like this group of people, basically online friends from the Discord that you were able to speak to alongside while experiencing sort of like this crazy stuff.
Well, I think with them, yes, but as well as just like going up to people at the conference, just being like, hey, enjoyed your talk, or different booths and stuff who were like, you know, just people have their DAOs there and whatnot. So like the conversations between the crypto leftists and I, and then other people who don't identify as leftists necessarily, but were talking about things like near and dear to our hearts, right? Like, how do we create a fair and equitable DAO structure that sort of, you know, they would say decentralizes governance rather than like explicitly calling that like democracy or worker owned or anything like that. And like talking to those people who weren't using the leftist language to like try and figure out where we were missing one another or where we agreed was like the valuable part.
Yeah, I think that is something that I've noticed, and I've mentioned before a lot, that when I go to these events, or even when you just hear them speak, they get so close sometimes to where you want them to go, and then they stop a little bit short. I don't know if it's necessarily just because they don't know, because we don't speak like necessarily the same language, or I mean, I think it's both. It's like they don't know the language, and they don't have maybe like exactly the same framework for thinking about like why the technology is interesting and why how it could be helpful versus like how it could also be like dystopian. They sort of like get really close, then they sort of like stop short. And part of, I think, the importance of going to events like that is for people like you to go and like speak to them directly, or like to add a little bit of like, to give a little bit of feedback, because I imagine, I mean, you tell me, like, if you ever had the chance to like give feedback to someone or like add on to like what they were saying in like a conversation or at a talk or something, that usually they would be receptive, at least like maybe because they're just being nice talking to you, but usually they'll be receptive to like sort of like more explicitly maybe socialist ideas. Is that correct?
I agree. I do think that there are a lot of, especially at Telling Point, like tons of value aligned people. But to your point, I think like where I was trying to dig in a little bit deeper on like kind of the terms that were being used. I do think that in this space, one of the things that like I'm cautious of, and even with our own organization, is like, I think that we're appropriating a lot of language. Like, for example, like many talks I heard use the term mutual aid, or use the term like, you know, like generative XYZ, or like community building. And you're like, what are these things really mean to you? Like, how is this NFT project that you're working on encouraging mutual aid? Like, and so I think one of the things that I was trying to drill into in talking to these people as well and follow-up conversations is like, wow, mutual aid, that resonates. But let's talk about how, are you guys actually accomplishing that, or how are you thinking about that? So that was one of the things I was kind of approaching the conversation with. James, I know that you had the opportunity to talk to quite a few more folks, or just attended way more of the talks than I did. So I'd love to hear how some of those conversations
sure. went for you. Sure. I mean, to your point, like the number of times I heard the word revolutionary that week would like, it would make anyone listening to this podcast head spin. revolutionary with your DeFi tokens. No. But yeah, like you had said, like talking to people directly after their talks was definitely like, interesting, because especially it always felt very approachable, maybe towards the end of the week when like at the beginning of the week it was like sort of smaller because like the big part of the conference hadn't started yet. So I think like, you know, especially at DeSci, for example, it was, you know, a few days they slated talks where people would talk about decentralizing science, how to, and you know, they had really good analysis generally around you know, what is the purpose of a journal? Why are they like acting as this middleman? They sort of siphon off money through the grants, through the funding of the schools. And they really broke down like very well why this is like an inefficient, and, you know, identifying where the incentive structures for money go. And then I think what people unfortunately don't go the step further is like, there were certain proposals to create, I mean, near direct funding of scientific projects through crypto rails by venture capitalists. And like, to it was very valuable to go up to those people after their talks and have a conversation about, like, we know what private science looks like. It looks like Purdue Pharma. It looks like an opioid crisis. Like the incentives around research in quote unquote healthcare, right, is, I mean, while it is healthcare, it's just, what are the externalities of that? What is the, you know, what incentives are you bringing in? What are you not taking account for? And I think having those conversations directly with people who were presenting those ideas, I mean, maybe it's not as, you know, cynical as I'm saying, or as direct as I'm saying, but at least bringing up those possibilities, people were definitely receptive to it. And I think that's sort of the value of having this kind of perspective there, is have this like critical eye for capital always in a space that, you know, essentially feels like it's printing money.
Yeah, I can imagine that's one of the things that is almost never, or very rarely questioned in these spaces, is just like profit motive and like the incentive for profit. I think there is this sort of, maybe because a lot of the people in this, in crypto are sort of like professional managerial class, kind of like well-educated, a bit like neoliberal subject, they sort of view profit motive as kind of like an inherently good thing, that if you do make profit, then surely you must be doing something good. As like a, you know, it's just like a representation of how good you are sometimes. So I imagine that, yeah, if you don't question that, then it's sort of like, we're taking away the middleman and we're accepting money from VCs. Like you sort of, you miss, without that sort of critical eye on capital and profits, then you can miss that. There could be problems with that. Did they, I wonder, in the DeSci stuff, did they actually mention Sci-Hub at all? Remember?
No, this was actually something I brought up afterwards. Yeah, that no one, you know, no one said Sci-Hub, right? They're talking about what should science look like. And it's like, was astounding that nobody talked about, hey, maybe all of this is truly, you know, open and act and able to be accessed, right? Like, what if it was truly just public science? And that's sort of what Sci-Hub's going on, especially, you know, with how much people try to invoke like the cypherpunk legacy, or like the, you know, sort of countercultural, or, you know, revolutionary, whatever you want to call it, legacy that crypto tries to inherit, whether it's an aesthetic or not. Yeah, like Sci-Hub is like genuinely inheriting that legacy. And you guys are talking about science. How could the entire, like, I mean, maybe it was the talks I was at, but I didn't hear it.
Did they not know what Sci-Hub was?
No, I think they did. Like in other conversations, like it came up, right? But I just don't think they thought that it would be, I don't know. Like, I don't know why.
I was going to say, I do think that there's, to your point, because of the type of person that is like gravitating towards crypto, even like, or this space, I think that even the people who are trying to do it well and, you know, like do like quote unquote ethical things within it, are like a little bit arrogant in that like they don't want to look at the past at all. And certainly like, even if they can say that they're kind of aligned with socialist ideas, they're like, but I would never consider myself a socialist or a communist, because those are like dated and clearly don't work. Like what we're doing here is building something new. And I think that that is like pretty dangerous, because it doesn't take into account like a historical political perspective into anything that's being built. And like, I think James brought this up quite a few times when we were watching different talks. Like, you know, it's kind of like, it's important to question like, well, why haven't we been there before, right? And to your point, like, we're kind of assuming that the default is that profit is the main objective. And like, certainly capital, socialism, like these, or sorry, socialism takes that and rejects it and helps like actually reframe the problem. So to your point, I guess I just have this fear that even a lot of like well-intentioned projects are like going to continue to like perpetuate capitalism, but just like have more like flowery language around it.
Yeah. And with that, I would say, I think like the base of a lot of like, if I had like one consistent critique after every talk, it where like this profit motive kind of thing was coming up, it was like, okay, like, you can be like good faith and believe the profit motive is an effective way of like allocating resources and, you know, getting good outcomes. But like, you have to address that when you create this protocol and you're trying to, you know, we're talking about creating a new economy, a new digital financial system and what else. But like, it would be naive to not address these incentives. And like, you can still create venture capitalists, you know, backed firms, whatnot, but like, it's in your like pitch to the crowd or whatever for your idea, you should address the fact that you're like, there's a history of bad incentives that come with this behavior. And I'm not saying you can't do it, because like, maybe that's the only way to do what you're doing, but like, you should directly lay out how you're going to account for this and then like defend, right? But that was kind of just very often I saw that was lacking.
It would be interesting to have it to where they needed to justify profit first as just like a normal thing that you need to justify. Where is profits in your, you know, supposed system that you're trying to pitch to us? Why does it make sense to do that? But of course, when you're pitching to potential investors and venture capitalists, then it's sort of like a given that, well, I'm justifying profit because it's going to make you and me a lot of money, which is, you know, of course, we can see as problematic.
Especially in like a public goods space where, like when people talk about what are public goods, like that was a question that came up a lot in Shelling Point, which I don't know if we've like clarified. Shelling Point was like a specific sub conference within ETH Denver that was talking about like public goods, governance, and, you know, building a more resilient ecosystem, and people talking about public goods. Like, I think ENS is a good example, even though it wasn't necessarily discussed at ETH Denver, but for the kinds of room for leftist critique and what is a public good because of how did the airdrop work, right? Who got those governance tokens? Who has a say over this new decentralized internet? It's people, it's a specific group of people who had a specific amount of capital to acquire an ENS domain. And how does that delegate voting work? And all those kinds of systems, right? And like calling ENS a public good when it's also just like somewhat of a click compared to the population of the whole internet, right? Like, basically, that critique can be applied to most all of the projects being proposed as public goods that I saw, except for ones that were like truly trying to just create like, you know, like I think IPFS looks like what a public good ought to look like, right? Like,
well, I'm curious more actually to hear about your thoughts on how much this word public goods gets used in especially places like Shelling Point and of course around the Gitcoin people and all this stuff. On one side, I somewhat admire what they do. On the other side, I'm also a bit like pedantically critical maybe about like how they use the word public goods and like whether or not that's actually a public good. And, you know, their conception of public is sort of like a very particular public, which means it's not public. but I'm curious, being there, what you guys thought of like how the word public good was used. Sometimes it also feels like it's used, like if I just call my profitable company a public good, then it's sort of like, it may wash over what exactly maybe, you know, the company is doing, which it's doing in order to like earn a profit.
Yeah, I think I feel like that about much of the language in the space. Like as mentioned, it's just like, you know, this like NFT gated, like ultra wealthy, like group, like is a social club is called a community. And like, you know, again, just terms like mutual aid and public goods, I do think are far overused. Like, it's like, what is this like public we are referring to? Like, I think one of my first like tweets when I came onto Twitter, like a few months ago, like I was seeing like wag me everywhere. And I'm like, who is we? Like, is it like this like upper class of like neoliberal people who are like basically being the like early adopters of these tools and this space? Or is the we are all going to make it like, speaking to, like you were saying, like this broader public, because we're going to create things that save us from capitalism. And I obviously hope it's the latter, but I have a sense that it's more the former. So yeah, I guess I can just echo, or I can confirm that public goods is used a nauseating amount when it wasn't exactly clear like what public goods are, or like how a particular project is serving the public.
And I think, you know, you had mentioned, you know, the word neoliberal, which I think is a whole other can of worms for like discussing the sort of ideology behind like one, the conception of public goods as presented at ETH Denver, or just like a lot of the space's ideas generally, where there is this like idea of like the public as being a public of consumers who like are allocating capital as preference, right? Like, I think, you know, it's, you can often hear like the very DeFi people, right? They'll talk about like your tokens as being almost like political statements. And I think that's just like the most dangerous of thinking, right? Because what does your citizenry look like in a society where political expression is represented by where you allocate capital, right? Like that, sure, that's something capitalists do, but like we are the public. We are, you know, like the workers do not do that. And when your conception of public good bakes into the like fact that, well, you know, we're going to have a sort of voting system with tokens where people can allocate here and they can, you know, delegate tokens there, right? If at some point there's a sort of buy-in, or if you're airdropping to everybody and then like, yeah, like people have to sell tokens to pay rent sometimes. And who's doing that? It's the real public, right? And the people who never have to do that, the people who can hold through a bear market are going to be like the people who the capitalists. And I think what you're left with is like this increasing precarity that they will end up placing on people by gating quote unquote public goods or the governance over them, right? Because the governance is going to reflect the desire, like it's going to reflect the desires of who has the most tokens at that point. And that's going to make the good itself serve their interests the most. And you increasingly marginalize people away from what otherwise would be a public good, right? Like it's not exactly, it's not public if it's serving the interests of your financial needs more than your literal needs as a, I don't know, an existing person on the internet.
Yeah, I get the impression that, I think a lot of the experimentation is interesting and fairly novel in the crypto space, more or less, as far as things go. But at the same time, a lot of the mental models that I think people are using to create, like for democratizing or decentralizing their protocols or their projects, just sort of like fits. It looks just like a stock market, like as if they're just like dropping shares to everyone, which is maybe better than like closed off, like, I don't know, stock public offerings that are only available to like people with a certain net worth or something like that. It might be better than that, but it's still like a incomplete, like there's still a lot wrong with it, I think, from our point of view, I would assume. And that's probably why a lot of these things sort of just look like if you are a socialist looking into it, it's sort of like, well, that just looks like the stock market, which is not really what I want. But also, I guess, decentralized ownership under capitalism also may kind of look like a stock market to a certain degree. Yeah, I guess, were there any other like sort of noteworthy things that you noticed while attending the conferences?
Well, I would say, you know,
your best story?
Best story? I mean, I would say probably connecting with the crypto leftists in the community. This is something like maybe more meta, but for the members of the Discord or people who hang out on the Reddit, I think it's like valuable and validating as someone who's in crypto. We obviously spend a lot of time either listening to podcasts or tweeting or reading tweets or scrolling wherever. And, you know, having a perspective we feel is not mainstream for this space. And especially when you want to talk to other leftists about it, it is generally, you know, it's line go up type content, right? It's, and so, yeah, I think my highlight would just be spending the week like walking around the conference being like, oh, hey, Matt, hey, Charles, what's going on? Like, and then talking to them and then being like, yeah, like there is someone here who has like the same lens and, you know, sort of foundational value system I have. And like, I would encourage anyone listening to this to try and connect with more people like that, because it's encouraging for staying in the space.
I think that if you do go, like, absolutely, like that is the way to do it. Like those were my favorite moments of all the like silly parties that I went to. Like my conversation with James and fellow crypto leftists were like my favorite, most enlightening parts of the conference. However, honestly, like I don't think that I would go to another conference like this. Like I think that it feels like having friends in the space who are coming from like multiple different places, like it feels like a hotbed for people who like want to shill their projects and who want to get funding. And And so it feels like a big networking event of people just kind of trying to like charm each other much of the time. And so I think with the nature of the project that we're working on and kind of the intention that I brought to East Denver, like much of it just felt like a mismatch. Like I would be like, oh, we're working on this mutual aid app. People would be like, what's mutual aid? We would talk about it and they'd be like, that's nice. And then it was like conversation over. And so I was like, you know, I think that they were wonderful learnings, but I think it made me question like, what am I doing here? Like it feels like a lot of the people at the conference have quite a different intention than I do. And I think that that's fair.
Also maybe what you expected.
Yeah, I guess it just also felt like icky environments sometimes. And so I was like, okay, like I maybe might have actually had, especially at events like Shelling Point, like might have had an easier time just tuning in from online because James might agree, but like at the conference, it was like so loud. It was like trying to listen to people talk in like a crowded cafeteria. And so, I feel like in many ways with the conference, like people listening online might have had a better experience.
Not surprising. I mean, that's sort of like my experience. I've been to, a few like very big crypto conferences on my own without knowing anybody who was going or like who politically agreed with me. So I definitely have had those type of frustrations and just been like, what the fuck? Who are these people who are talking to me and why do they think like this? For sure. But one of the, later now, recently, more and more, I've been able to find conferences that either I agree with more or that like I know other people who are going, and that makes the experience a lot better. But indeed, I had these experience of just the worst people coming up to me, to be honest. Sorry if you're listening, but like really the absolute last people I want to talk to in my life, because I could not care less about your like Minecraft NFT projects, making a new metaverse bullshit, so there's a lot of those type of people. I think you have to, if you like prepare for that, it's a little bit better if you like kind of know that's going to happen and if you can like kind of make fun of them, to be honest. For me, it's helpful. if you can like speak their language and make fun of them a bit, it's kind of nice. But otherwise, it's, I can imagine, very frustrating.
Yeah, and I think with that, there was as far as getting to like, if we're getting to my doubts or skepticism, I think I was kind of also taken aback by the like amount of projects I was just kind of like, really, like, and like, I'm sorry to be so pejorative about it, like that is a shit coin, that's a shit token. Like,
yeah, there's really like a lot of that for sure,
and it's somewhat scary because I'm like, oh wow, like I, you know, we're here because we genuinely believe in the potentially transformative or impactful power of this technology, and this is something I was towards the end of the week talking about more, was like, if this is like a bubble, which like I think a lot of people might be starting to like kind of acknowledge more and more, if and when it bursts, like what happens on the outside of that? I was starting to get worried about like a sort of dot-com boom type situation where what walks out of like this current, I don't know, people use the word Cambrian explosion a lot at the conference, right? Like, look at all these DAOs, there's new ones every day. If like you suddenly don't have like the resources to start a token, or you know, ETH is too low and all your treasury assets disappeared and now your DAO had to dissolve, right? Who comes out on the other side of that? It's no longer this, like, even though it's not that democratic or decentralized anyway, but it's no longer like thousands of DAOs. It's maybe like hundreds, right? That are actually have sizable treasuries anymore, that actually are going to build the space. And who's at the helm of that, right? Like, I was envisioning, right? There's a world where something goes wrong in the space, like the price of ETH or whatever your treasury crypto asset tanks. You might need like a bailout. You might need the venture capitalists to come in and like set a floor for your token or give you lending or something, right? And there's going to be strings attached. And I sort of by the end of the week started having more conversations about, in the event of like a systemic shock to the crypto economy, who steps in to like stabilize it, and who survives, and why do they survive, and what are the rules attached to coming out of that, and like what kind of consolidation did you have to do? Are you going to like, I don't know, buy up other like NFT DAOs, right? And now there's like some kind of big conglomerate with like a bunch of the originally previously very valuable NFTs. I can just like sit on it for like 4 years till the next bull run comes around or whatever. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of scary to imagine like either like a, you know, 2008, right? Like not literally that for the whole economy, but like, do the bailouts come? Like, I mean, there's no government to do it, right? Or does that include more government regulation now because people are losing so much money? And it was definitely like that kind of doomsday scenario was never really discussed at a conference all about Ethereum, right? No one really talked about what do we do if Ethereum starts to fail? What does that mean for DeFi, DeSci, governance, all this stuff, right? People just kind of, I don't think they assume they would keep on trucking. I just don't even think people really engage with that kind of idea. But the shit coins definitely started getting me worried about, wow, there is like millions and millions of dollars that are in projects that are never going to succeed.
I mean, as someone who like sort of, like I remember 2016, 2017 into 2018, I think it was, whenever there was like the ICO boom, where a lot of projects did make like millions without making anything almost. Like I remember witnessing that and thinking exactly the same thing. And then there eventually was like the crash of like 90% from like the all-time high. Where afterwards it was, I mean, from what I can tell, most of the ones that got, like there was a lot of projects. There may have been like a lot of scams, but the scams generally got a lot less than the ones that were, could not be considered to be a scam, or they either made something or they attempted to make something. But indeed, there was like this huge killing off of these projects during that crash. But the difference here, I think now, if a similar thing were to happen, like back then, you couldn't do anything with your cryptocurrency. Like you couldn't, there was no such thing as DeFi. There's no such thing as like any application. Whereas now you have a lot of different like tooling, which I think could make it way more complicated.
And I think especially with the kinds of public goods visions people are talking about, where like maybe the maximalist case for Ethereum, right? Like we're talking about a very large proportion of the internet being directly or indirectly reliant on the security of Ethereum, right? Or, you know, using smart contracts, right? Like this is the decentralized utopia of the Ethereum maximalist. And maybe, yeah, they'll talk about a multi-chain future. But at some point, right, the ecosystem is going to be too interconnected. Like if a shock happened to Ethereum, they could take down, like, it could be like a ripple out to the whole economy, right? Like at what point does crypto become big enough and integral enough to the actual like internet infrastructure that it's not like this marginal bubble burst on the side of the economy? And I think that's like a responsibility that at like ETH Denver, right? Like the biggest ETH conference, whatever, someone should mention that, you know, what we're talking about here, like comes with great responsibility. And yeah, I mean, what would one do, right? And maybe not now, but in the next bull run, if there was to be like a burst, and maybe at that point, there's like hundreds of millions of people onboarded into crypto by then, who's going to be there to like, you know, help them, protect them? Like, they're not gonna be able to say they work in a DAO, right? Are they losing their jobs? Are they going to get unemployment, right? What does the legal structure look like? You know, there's a lot of concerns for what we would do if we actually succeeded in this.
My impression is that there are still a lot of dependencies on, I guess, like the meat-based economy, the real economy, that I think a lot of people in crypto world still feel like, I mean, they just don't have any control over, or they like, so it's easy to present like what happens in the real economy as like kind of like the enemy, or like is the consequence of I don't know, governments doing XYZ or something like that. There's always like, it's easy. I think they're in a place where it's very easy to flip the script to where it's, you know, it's never going to be crypto's fault. And I think partially that maybe that's like partially true. I think it like the fault is probably likely going to be more in the real economy is my guess. But that still doesn't deny that like there are going to be implications for, you know, you or like people who are trusting you to invest in your project or whatever. Yeah, I think it would be really interesting to also hear about the project that you are both working on. So could you tell us about Pact Collective and what you guys are doing?
Sure. So we are based in New York City, and we're looking to kind of make like a sustainable mutual aid model, and using New York City as our first go at it. We started as a Web2 project a couple years ago during the pandemic to help get funding to different local grassroots organizations. Like, people did not want to donate to Red Cross New York. They wanted to get their funds to their neighbors. And so we were running as like a cooperative for a couple of years before hearing about Web3. And we're attracted to Web3 because many of the kind of issues or areas of opportunity that we were being faced with at the time were around centered in our tools. Like, Pact was originally set up as kind of like a single member LLC, and to truly bring everybody else on our team was going and like incorporate us as a company or whatever kind of structures were available at the time just were far too costly for like our size. And similarly with like getting everybody like assigned onto a bank account from the different regions that we were in, it just was too sizely, too costly. And so we kind of were like puttering out for a while. We were like, how do we truly become a cooperative like with the tools at hand? And then so about 6 to 8 months ago, we were learning about Web3, we were learning about DAOs, and decided to take our project into this fun little crypto land. And so, yeah, so we're in our season zero, currently building out our team, building relationships with local mutual aid organizations on the ground. And yeah, gonna launch season one in a couple weeks.
Cool, yeah. And you guys are part of BreadChain.
Yes, and we are part of BreadChain.
So like, from the impression I get is that Pact came out of maybe a lot of the organizing and protesting and action that was happening, maybe like sort of towards the beginning of the pandemic and like the Black Lives Matter protests that were popular back then. There was like a surge, I remember, of a lot of people wanting to be like, I want to give my money to like more local organizations or like organizations that I know that are going, trying to solve the problems in my area, or rather than sort of like these giant charities that you like really have no idea what they're doing with your money.
Right, exactly. I think there's a lot of mistrust around the funds, and rightly so, right? You receive like so much direct mail and kind of different pieces of marketing from these organizations. Like, people aren't stupid. Like, they understand that that's like probably like half of where their dollar is going. Yeah, and I think that there is a lot of criticism, especially over the past couple of years, like with Dean Spade's book, Mutual Aid, and many other pieces of literature before it, that kind of talk about like the nonprofit industrial complex as a system that works to basically kind of remedy, like almost like remedy harm, or like apply like these like patchwork solutions, but aren't creating infrastructure that addresses like the root problem, which is capitalism, which is extraction, which is a lot of other things. And so, yeah, mutual aid, both conceptually, as we were talking about in the Web3 space and how much it's kind of becoming an appropriated term there. But yeah, mutual aid is definitely entering the mainstream and becoming something that people think about as a way of living.
And I guess you sort of saw that at ETH Denver or Shelling Point, where people were using the word mutual aid. So maybe could you explain how you guys are sort of creating a mutual aid network versus maybe the misconceptions that maybe some of these crypto people who may like the term mutual aid because they heard it maybe during these protests, but don't really understand what exactly it is?
Yeah, so I think maybe to get at that, we could talk about our like maybe initial focus or something we want to make. You know, our first step as we convert from like Web 2 to 3 is, you know, we have this pool of funds of Ethereum and, you know, dollar donations. And I think a problem we think about with, you know, traditional either like philanthropy or charity is that there's like this middleman organization with its own incentives and own biases. Like, I mean, the worst, I don't even think you can really call it charity, right? The Bill and Melinda Gates, like, that's just like an investment firm that invests in like quote unquote charity, right? And like, that's the worst example of a middleman. So like, our focus being, how much power can we take away from Pact as the people currently holding the treasury? And how can we enable the organizations themselves, who are, I mean, hopefully credibly, you know, representative of their community's needs in some capacity, because they, you know, from the ground up, found the need, started meeting them in their own communities, and create a sort of shared responsive governance model where they have direct control over the funds, and there's no room for, you know, maybe there's a whale comes in with a bunch of Ethereum and hears about a mutual aid project and says, hey, this is like really good. It's not only good for like my crypto branding because I'm donating directly ETH into mutual aid, but like, oh no, I can't attach strings to it because they have built into their smart contracts that these organizations get to vote on where my donation goes, right? Like I can't give it to, you know, my niece's charity, right? Even though I'm going to wash it through this crypto mutual aid fund or something. You know what I mean? Like the kind of traditional murky water. Anyway, so like getting back to ETH Denver, I think a lot of the models people were talking about for public goods and mutual aid don't sort of look at the existing problems of philanthropy, right? Because it's a room full of venture capitalists. Like they're not going to criticize their own tax breaks, right? They all do quote unquote philanthropy to their chosen charities to write it off on their taxes. They're not going to talk about when building new mutual aid, how shitty of a system that is and how unresponsive it is to the actual communities. So like even the people who don't feel like they're beholden to the venture capitalists, I still feel like they're in the same room as them when they're talking about like, we're going to fund our, you know, crypto public good or mutual aid or like donation thing through like token sales. And that's going to give, you know, governance structures, whatever. I mean, even people talking about like quadratic voting, crypto is not at the place where like regular people in New York City are going to be like buying DeFi tokens to like quadratically vote in a mutual aid DAO. You know, that like that is not a sustainable model to actually include the people you're claiming to represent. And I think like, you know, people kind of will hand wave away, well, you know, DeFi needs to grow and mature a bit before we can start onboarding regular quote unquote internet users. I think the people directly, the people helped the most by this kind of mutual aid are going to be the last people onboarded to, you know, crypto probably, right? Because there's one, like, you know, you need capital lying around to get into it, right? To pay the gas fees or whatever. But two, I mean, there's so many people who don't have regular internet access, right? Like, especially unhoused people. They're not going to be expected to have DeFi tokens to have their needs met. They need some kind of institutional way to be credibly represented in ways that, you know, are not currently addressed.
Right. And to add on to that, I think that's why with our season one, we'll be working directly with mutual aid groups who are working on the ground and who are serving like the most vulnerable in our community, right? Because as James was saying, like, it's not our goal to digitize mutual aid and to do away with it or quote unquote, like bring it into the metaverse or necessarily like bring it into the cryptoverse. Like, I think that our goal is to like consider the real public and consider like the work that is being done and not only like learn from it, but help bolster it, help sustain it, like, by providing funding, by, you know, collaborating with them side by side, perhaps like building technical tools.
How do you guys connect the digital with the on the ground work of these like different local groups in New York City?
I would just say that our like first, you know, we're early impact, right? I don't want to oversell what we're have already accomplished or something, but our current, you know, plan is to try and work with the organizations themselves and sort of indirectly treat them as representatives to start, right? So, you know, if you are a food pantry or if you're a shelter or if you're, you know, a closed distribution center, right? At least in our assessment of these organizations, they are community members themselves who see and interact with these people every day. They're not like nonprofit, you know, employees who live in the Upper East Side or something. Like, they're members of the community. I think it's perhaps in a lower bar to hurdle to try and work with them as representatives to sort of help be the bridge. And part of our problems right now that we're trying to address or like discuss is how do we even then, right, like make this as accessible as possible to them? Because even the representative that we might be working with might not be, you know, ready to jump into Web3. So we want to, you know, probably one of our biggest challenges is how do we, one, lower that hurdle and not do any sort of decision fatigue where we're constantly asking them for input on PACT, right? Because they're not going to, you know, have the time necessarily or the ability to contribute constantly over governance decisions or something like that.
So you're just sort of like treating it as like a federation of these different mutual aid networks that are part of pact and give them a type of like democratic say in how you guys function. And then I'm wondering, do these organizations, do they have bank accounts, or do they have like legal entities usually with them, or is that part of the challenge?
From the organizations that I've spoken with, it's like quite a mix. Like some of them are more developed or incorporated or sophisticated, and they like work with other mutual aid groups, and they have like storage units, and they have bank accounts and like small like LLC set up for their operations. And other people are just making it work like from their homes. Like they're storing donations in their like 300 square foot apartment in like the closet, and they're, you know, just kind of like putting the pieces together. And so I think that we want to kind of meet everyone where they're at in their journey, as James was saying, and as well provide them like some kind of stability, like some kind of funding that they can rely on, and yeah, really kind of help bolster their operations.
Yeah, I feel like it, in the same way that maybe Gitcoin and these type of organizations may see open source software or like the different crypto protocols that they're building as public goods. I kind of see maybe like one idea that I'm playing with is whether it's worth to look at these type of like activist organizations or these mutual aid organizations that you guys would be working with as a type of public good that should be funded. Like obviously there should be like state support or what have you to make sure that what they're doing is able to continue to be done. But in the absence of all that, they're not treated as such. And so it's, you know, if you want to do this type of work, then of course you need to make money somehow. And that's really difficult if, you know, maybe what you want to do is good for society, but it's not good for your bank account. And therefore, you know, you're not, even if what you're doing sort of brings a net positive to that community and maybe like you could argue like saves the government money or whatever, because they're not being funded, then there is sort of like this need for autonomous organization, maybe while also fighting for like public funding as well.
Yeah, and I think this might be where I sort of like tip my ideological hand a bit, and I'll say that I think that's exactly it. That identification of mutual aid is sort of filling the cracks where the state left behind, right? Like if we're talking about housing for the unhoused or food for the hungry or, you know, clothing for people who need it, right? Like we can imagine, I mean, especially as socialists, as like the most base level socialist, that like those things do not need a community organization. Or if you're like, I mean, at least like a state socialist, right? Maybe you would say, okay, yes, the government should be doing that. And I think, you know, I sort of see the need for mutual aid as only growing in the like increasing austerity of like living under like neoliberal hegemony, right? Like there is going to be increasingly a need for organizations that are going to fill in the gaps where the state is sort of receding. And I think that's sort of exactly what a public good looks like, right? Because public goods are things the state usually is responsible for. And mutual aid is, I see, another way to get to public good, right? If you have a well-funded network of shelters or food distribution, that one could be something the state does and the state handles. But when it's done by members of the community for one another, that's when it moves into an area called mutual aid. And I think like that's sort of why, like as part of crypto, and if we think this could be transformative, and if we want to build something to last, you know, throughout the next 20, 30 years, if crypto is going to stay around, it would be something exactly like this, something exactly like creating the financial tooling to support this kind of grassroots public goods infrastructure via mutual aid that can support people in a world with, you know, increasing neoliberal austerity or climate catastrophe or whatever else is going on. You have to look somewhere. People can't go unsupported, and making sure that it's directly accountable to those people is like, you know, the project itself. And yeah, I think that's something that is not like a commonly held view in the public goods crypto space. And that they don't see the reasons why mutual aid is even needed as being the same venture capitalists sitting in the room with them that are going to fund their public goods project, right? Like, we need these things because our government's been co-opted by capital in some capacity. We need these things because there's, you know, a military-industrial complex siphoning off public funding, right? If we're going to assume there's a limit to public funding in some capacity. But yeah, I mean, I think that sort of analysis is exactly the kind of left analysis of public goods that I identify with and I see as completely absent from ETH Denver, for example.
Right. And I guess the when you say like the spaces left open or like that are left by the states because they're not sort of like fulfilling what they would do in like a social democratic society or something like that. Under neoliberalism has sort of like largely been filled with privatization. So I guess mutual aid as like an alternative to privatization, and a big way you can tell the difference, at least one of the differences between mutual aid and privatization is like, is the profit motive and like the need for making a profit. And so like if you know, you're saying you're making a crypto mutual aid project while accepting, you know, Andreessen Horowitz funding, then like, you know, it's total bullshit. You know, you're not really like thinking very critically about what you're doing, obviously. And so of course, where in the crypto world, sometimes the profit motive simply isn't questioned enough, then it's very easy for your, what you would like to call mutual aid, because maybe you heard it in like, you know, a nice sounding optimistic video or something like that, then it quickly becomes privatization, just because of, or like a nonprofit industrial complex, as you said earlier, something like that, which has its own issues. And then there's also the addition, I guess, of like mutual aid not being solely about money, but also about like things and like physical things and like, I don't know, giving food or giving water or like, rather than solely giving money or like relying on money for the network to function. But money under the world that we live in is sort of like a pretty important aspect in all this.
Unfortunately, so.
One of the last things I wanted to ask you guys is what recommendations you would have for others who may want to go to events like this or think about getting involved. For getting involved with it when it comes to the conference, going to conferences.
Yeah, I can kind of just mirror what James said earlier. If you do decide to go, one, wear a mask. I think everybody got COVID after ETH Denver, myself included. I would say, like, just go and find your people. Go and find the events, because there are typically, like, pretty specific events that are catered to people with different interests. Like, the space is big and filled with all different kinds of players. And I would just say go and find your people. Go and find the things that are interesting and follow them. And listen to the talks and make friends. And I think also, like, think critically about what you're hearing. I think everything is new and we're all in this, like, we're going to brave this new world together, like, kind of, which has, like, its own colonizer language implications to it. But I do think, like, I think go meet your people and think critically about what's being said.
Yeah, and I would, I'd echo that, definitely, like, finding your people and thinking critically. And I might add, like, you know, while you're sitting there, right, like thinking about this and maybe discussing with, you know, left-minded or critical other like people, you know, with you, I'd say don't like be afraid to approach the presenter, or don't be, you know, hesitant to do that, because like the space is so new, like the quote unquote like crypto celebrities or big names, like 2 years ago, right, like everyone's a nobody. There's not like, no one's really gonna, I don't know, no one, I don't think anyone's that far, like, you know, on their high horse or something, that if you have like a critical and thoughtful like response to their talk, like I think that might have been one of the most valuable parts for me, was being able to directly engage with people about what they're presenting in a space that, you know, you can see, right, the collective of people happening or present at ETH Denver are going to build this space that we all sort of collectively believe can be very impactful. And there's real value in talking to those people you recognize as sitting at different positions of influence or power in this ecosystem, right? And being able to engage with them critically is so worth it. And I would advise anyone to go to these and just like stay critical, like, you know, especially the socialists listening to this, right? You have like, you can engage with them. And I think people are receptive to that. And I would, yeah, definitely recommend going to crypto conferences and giving your perspective.
Yeah, I would say that, for anybody who's listening, you probably have like a much more interesting or thoughtful thing to say to the speaker who maybe you just listened to than like the five other people who went up to them to like shill their metaverse Minecraft NFT project. So like definitely don't be afraid to go up and talk to them, because you know, who cares? And you know, they're not going to like remember you and like make fun of you afterwards. I mean, I might make fun of you if you like shill a Minecraft NFT project, but
not letting that guy off, huh?
Poor guy.
But I mean, yeah. I think he got the idea pretty quickly that I was uninterested in what he was saying, but yeah. Sorry to that guy. Cool. Where can people keep up with you and Pact, and where should they give Pact money? Because they should.
Sure. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is PactDAO. In our bio is our Mirror crowdfund, where we kind of have like some of our plans for the next couple of seasons laid out, and where we're accepting Ethereum, and you can get an NFT in exchange for your contribution, as well as like membership into our Discord. However, we also accept US dollars as a result of being this Web2 project, and because most of these organizations operate in US dollars and need those.
Wow, you guys are accepting that shit coin, US dollar?
USD, not USDC, or, what?
Yeah, exactly, the old school stuff. So yeah, you can find us there at thepactcollective.com, subscribe with us, starting at just $3 a month. And yeah, I think that's about it. Oh, well, we're also a member of Bread Chain, and so soon you'll be able to mint some bread.
Yes, that should be hopefully available pretty soon. James, did you want to...
Well, I would say, yeah. I mean, if you guys want to follow me or Marissa on Twitter, my handle's at JT_Bren, B-R-E-N. But yeah, I mean, I think like Marissa said, you can find us on Mirror. You can find us on Twitter. Well, starting to be more active.
In the Discord.
Yeah, I was about to say, you can also join our Discord. I forget sometimes we're a DAO, so we must have a Discord where we post different mutual aid opportunities in New York. And as well as we have weekly meetups, you know, just for members of the DAO to get together, sometimes go to happy hours or hang out or whatnot. I would definitely say if you're in New York and you're listening to this, like, please reach out to us. We want to connect with people interested in this stuff, whether through Discord or Twitter or whatever else. Definitely come hang out, even. Don't have to join the DAO, just come to one of our meetups. That'd be really cool to meet you guys.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I'm sure we'll have more conversations in the future. So yeah, thanks for coming on and sharing your experience at ETH Denver.